Sisters, Excellencies, colleagues, friends, we are starting the panel that has the title Acting in Concert in the Balkans and Elsewhere. How can institutional cooperation make the world more secure? I'm proud to be able to chair this panel. I would like to welcome the cooperation of distinguished members of this panel. Pierre Lelouch is a member of the French National Assembly and president of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. Nicholas Burns is Under Secretary for Political Affairs in the Department of State of the United States. Kolinda Grabar-Kitarovic, she is Minister of Foreign Affairs of Croatia. Kastriot Islami is Foreign Minister of Albania. And we have James Ellis, Member of European Parliament, Chairman of the Transatlantic Policy Network. And last is Nicholas White, Director of the European Programme of the International Crisis Group. Our rapporteur, our boss actually, is Jamie Shee, whom NATO members and NATO aspirants know for some time, have known for some time. He's Deputy Assistant Secretary General for External Relations in the Public Diplomacy Division, one of the most important people in NATO in this organization that is meeting here today. Absolutely. Now, if you allow me, I shall say a few words of introduction, and then I shall invite other members of this panel to participate in the debate. First, I shall not be alone in saying that it is a pleasure to take part in this panel discussion. But before turning the floor over to the speakers, I would like to give to you an overview of how the OSCE cooperates with international partners. Many examples I shall mention will be taken from the Balkans as well as other parts of the OSCE area. Generally speaking, the basic premise of our approach is cooperation with the countries, with the host countries, where we work in and cooperation with international partners. This cooperation manifests itself in many ways. The most common are regular contacts between OSCE institutions, field missions, and units of the Secretariat with the host states. In this way, the OSCE offers support through providing recommendations and programmatic support on a range of issues, from, for example, amending legislation to community policing, destroying ammunition stockpiles, and combating trafficking in human beings. The OSCE is only one of the players in the international security network. We therefore maintain regular contacts with, for example, the United Nations and its agencies, the European Union, Council of Europe, NATO, as well as sub-regional organizations and NGOs, in order to effectively complement our work. We have, this is something that I wanted to stress, we have to avoid duplication of resources, and we have to avoid forum shopping, as it is being called. Inter-institutional cooperation occurs at different stages. There are, of course, regular contacts between secretariats, working meetings, and regular high-level coordination meetings, for example, with the UN, EU, NATO, and Council of Europe. Let me say something about sharing information and expertise. At various levels, we share information. Some international partners draw on information from OSCE field mission reports. A good example was through our border monitoring work in Albania and Macedonia in 1998 and 1999, when the OSCE had a presence on Albania's northern border and monitored the flow of refugees and the humanitarian situation during the crisis in Kosovo. The OSCE gave early warning to the international community about the dangers of a spillover of the conflict. As a result, coordinated international action was taken and a crisis was averted. Now, the OSCE, I speak a lot about the OSCE since I'm its chairman in office, you have noticed that. The OSCE shares its expertise with other partners and vice versa. This is particularly the case in the human dimension, where the OSCE and the Council of Europe are taking steps to make more effective use of each other's strengths to improve practical cooperation and avoid duplication. In Kosovo, the European Union pillar and the European Agency of Reconstruction participate in the OSCE Managed Assembly Support Initiative, an interagency coordination mechanism for democratization programs aimed at building capacity in the Assembly of Kosovo. The OSCE is also increasingly consulted by the EU and NATO in regard to their action plans in OSCE participating states as they become more active in the South Caucasus, in Moldova, and in Central Asia. My impression is that sharing of information and expertise will increase and become more important as the area of activities for major organizations like the OSCE, EU, NATO, and the Council of Europe overlaps, and the challenges to security become more complex and cross-dimensional. We will therefore need to keep each other well informed of developments and of each other's activities, share ideas, experiences, and best practices to tackle common problems, and talk to each other in the field in order to avoid stepping on each other's toes and duplicating resources. Let me say something about the common tasks. It may be that there are tasks that we can carry out together. This is already the case in some OSCE activities. In Kosovo, for example, the OSCE, the UN, and the EU closely cooperate as partners in the UNMIK pillar structure. The OSCE pillar is responsible for institution building. The two UN pillars deal with civil administration and police and justice, and the EU pillar works on economic reconstruction. All three organizations have distinct and separate mandates, but there are naturally areas where they work together. For example, the standards process is an obvious case where representatives from each organization have closely cooperated, both in the drafting of the implementation plan for certain key standards and subsequently in monitoring the provisional institution of self-governance, progress in putting that plan into practice. The OSCE and NATO are planning to conduct joint assessments and joint implementation of projects on environmental security and on the disposal of ammunition and small arms and light weapons. These projects build on existing good cooperation with NATO. For example, in the Balkans, where we have a good record in cooperation on security sector reform and governance. Border management is a good example of a multifaceted subject that requires multi-institutional cooperation. In the Balkans, the OSCE has been working with NATO, the EU, and the Stability Pact to develop integrated border management strategies in the region through the so-called Ohrid process. Ohrid is the place in Macedonia. This type of experience could also be used in other areas, also involving other partners. A few more words on crisis management and conflict resolution. When crises erupt, we have to be ready and we have to pull together. There is no formal mechanism for pooling resources during a crisis or for sharing information. It is ad hoc and usually coordinated on the ground, especially during a fast-breaking crisis. In Kyrgyzstan, for example, the OSCE has a lead role in seeking a political resolution of the crisis. But the Kyrgyz authorities also seek humanitarian assistance and economic support. Here, we defer to others better able to help, for example, UNDP and international financial institutions. When civil unrest swept through Albania in 1998, the OSCE led the international stabilization effort and provided the framework under which a number of organizations and a military coalition of the willing helped to restore order and support reconciliation. In the autumn and winter of 2000, regional tensions threatened to spill over into the Preševo Valley in South Serbia. Together with NATO, the OSCE managed to diffuse the tensions, facilitated dialogue, promoted local self-government, and assisted with reforms, including community policing. During the crisis in Macedonia between 2001 and 2003, the OSCE, EU and NATO worked closely together and with the parties to stabilize the situation and hammer out the so-called Ohrid Agreement that I have already mentioned. Increasingly, the European Union is becoming involved in conflict resolution, for example, with special representatives for the South Caucasus and Moldova. The OSCE, which has a mandate and lead role in working with the parties in resolving the Transnistrian, Georgian-Ossetian and Nagorno-Karabakh conflicts, frequently consults with the EU and other international partners on developments in these conflicts. There is also concrete cooperation, for example, in the zone of the Georgian-Ossetian conflict, where the OSCE cooperates with the EU, particularly on issues of the economic rehabilitation of the zone of conflict, and implements an EU-funded project. And I'd like to conclude with the special relationship with the United Nations. The OSCE has a special relationship with the UN. It is a regional arrangement under Chapters 8 of the United Nations Charter. Where possible, we try to shoulder the burden of the UN community in the OSCE area. For example, in Kosovo, the OSCE mission, so-called OMIC, is a key pillar of the UN's UNMIC mission. I hope that OMIC can take on an even greater portion of the UN's role in Kosovo in the years ahead. Recently, the OSCE opened a new chapter in its relations with the UN by taking on a greater responsibility for working with the ICTI to monitor war crimes trials in Croatia, Serbia and Montenegro and Bosnia and Herzegovina. The OSCE helps participating states implement international commitments at a regional level. For example, we work with the UN Counterterrorism Committee and the UN Office for Drugs and Crime to assist OSCE states to implement UN resolutions on counterterrorism. We also work closely with the UN Economic Commission for Europe to monitor implementation of economic and environmental commitments. We agree with the recommendations of the United Nations High-Level Panel and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, which call for the UN to make more effective use of its relations with regional organizations. In turn, I think that the OSCE could go even farther in developing its links with sub-regional organizations. To conclude, I would like to underline the need for effective coordination and pragmatic cooperation. This does not require countless meetings. It takes common sense, open channels of communication, and a healthy sense of realism about the potential role of contributors. Organizations should act where they have something to offer and not to be afraid to defer to others who are more suitable for the situation at hand. States should take a more interested role in ensuring that their institutions serve their needs and priorities and defend the interests and values that they were created for. Wherever possible, I believe that the OSCE expertise should be offered to other regions of the world. This is a trend in NATO and in the EU, and also in the OSCE, where in 2004 the organization sent an election support team to Afghanistan to assist with the presidential elections. This was an excellent example of cooperation between the OSCE, the UN, NATO, and the UN, and demonstrated how the OSCE can help other regions promote security and democracy. I believe it could serve as a model for other operations in the future. So I thank you for your attention, and I would like to invite Pierre Lelouch to make his contribution. Thank you.
Merci. I would like to, first of all, thank our Swedish hosts for the perfect organization of the meeting. We are far from any conflicts here. We are far from any international organization. And if distance is proportional to wisdom, I'm sure we'll be very wise today. Maintenant que j'ai dit ça, je vais continuer en français, naturellement, et je voudrais, en guise d'introduction, dire d'abord que je suis un universitaire au départ, et ensuite un homme politique. Donc je ne vais pas prétendre ce matin être diplomate d'aucune façon, mais essayer de mettre en perspective la question qui nous intéresse ce matin, c'est-à-dire le besoin d'une meilleure coopération entre les organisations internationales pour améliorer notre efficacité dans le maintien de la paix, la reconstruction des États en faillite, etc. La première remarque que je ferai, c'est une remarque de nature historique. À la fin de la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, les vainqueurs avaient une organisation internationale mondiale qui était basée elle-même sur l'expérience de l'échec de la Société des Nations. Quelques organisations spécialisées en matière économique, monétaire ou en matière de santé. Et les organisations en matière de sécurité étaient dédiées et étaient incluses dans un projet stratégique qui était l'endiguement de l'Union soviétique. Et l'OTAN avait un rôle extrêmement précis dans cette affaire. L'OTAN qui a permis le réarmement de l'Allemagne et à partir de là a permis la naissance du processus d'intégration européenne dans la paix, dans la partie ouest de l'Europe. La difficulté aujourd'hui, c'est que nous ne sommes plus du tout dans la même phase de l'histoire. Nous avons, depuis la fin de la guerre froide, une explosion, une prolifération des conflits, et ce sont souvent des conflits à l'intérieur des États, des conflits qui révèlent soit l'implosion d'une région, soit l'implosion d'États. Et nous avons aussi vu une prolifération du nombre d'institutions qui, de près ou de loin, s'occupent de ces conflits. Sans parler d'institutions internationales, sans parler des organisations non gouvernementales, et tous ceux qui ont été sur les zones de guerre ont trouvé des dizaines, voire des centaines d'organisations privées, internationales, qui sont là, sur le terrain, à côté des organisations internationales. Donc nous avons un véritable fouillis d'organisations internationales différentes les unes des autres. L'ONU, je ne vais pas ici vous faire l'injure de vous rappeler les différences entre les unes et les autres, l'ONU étant la source de la légitimité et du droit international, l'OSCE ayant la compétence que son président vient de rappeler, l'Union européenne ayant à la fois des compétences civiles, politiques, monétaires, et un début, un embryon de compétences en matière militaire, et l'OTAN restant, dans l'après-guerre froide, une organisation militaire qui cherche un rôle politique et qui même se cherche une mission. Si le thème de la coopération, ou de la complémentarité, ou de la compétition, ou de la concurrence entre ces organisations est notre sujet aujourd'hui, a été évoqué hier soir, aussi bien hier soir que ce matin à nouveau par les orateurs, c'est que chacun sent bien que ça ne marche pas très bien. Dans les Balkans, je rappelle que les Occidentaux sont intervenus dans un désordre assez considérable jusqu'à ce que l'OTAN intervienne. Et quand l'OTAN est intervenue, elle est intervenue sans mandat des Nations Unies. Je crois que ce n'est pas inutile de le rappeler. En Irak, les États-Unis ont préféré agir seuls, sous la base d'une coalition ad hoc, avec une OTAN qui, par ailleurs, était paralysée par ses propres divisions internes, et des Nations Unies qui étaient également paralysées à cause des différends entre les membres, certains des membres permanents du Conseil de sécurité. En Afghanistan, on a aujourd'hui une situation où l'OTAN gère la partie militaire et même de plus en plus la partie de reconstruction civile, à côté de l'intervention des Nations Unies et de l'Union européenne et d'un nombre incalculable d'organisations non gouvernementales. Dans le Darfour, hier même, on a vu l'OTAN et l'Union européenne, si j'ai bien compris, faire exactement les mêmes propositions à l'OUA en termes de soutien logistique. Et dans le Caucase, où là aussi je peux parler comme témoin visuel de ce que j'ai vu, on a une OSCE qui fait le meilleur travail possible, mais avec peu de moyens, et avec, en face d'elle, une franche résistance d'une partie, si vous voyez ce que je veux dire, d'une partie importante. Mais il y a un autre volet à ce que je viens de dire. Non seulement ça ne marche pas très bien, mais en plus, il y a sous-jacent, en tout cas dans l'affaire euro-américaine, ici nous sommes en train de parler du partenariat euro-atlantique dont il n'est pas inutile de parler des relations euro-américaines, un débat nouveau est en train de s'installer entre Européens et Américains sur le rôle respectif de l'Union européenne d'une part et de l'OTAN d'autre part. Ce débat, il était sous-jacent jusqu'au début de cette année où le président Bush lui-même, en venant à Bruxelles, au siège de l'Union européenne, a solennellement reconnu l'Union européenne comme un partenaire, et pas seulement un partenaire économique, mais aussi bien un partenaire politique. Et puis, ceux qui étaient à la Wehrkunde début février à Munich se souviennent de cette phrase célèbre du discours du chancelier néo-gaulliste Schröder, qui a dit, j'ai la citation en anglais, « NATO is no longer the primary venue where transatlantic partners discuss and coordinate strategy », et il ajoutait « Current EU-US dialogue doesn't do justice neither to the Union growing importance nor to the new demand of transatlantic relations ». Donc, le moins qu'on puisse dire, c'est qu'une dialectique complexe est en train de s'instaurer entre l'OTAN et l'Union européenne dans l'affirmation du rôle politique et stratégique de l'Europe et le centre de gravité dans les relations euro-américaines. Ironiquement, tout ceci est en train de se passer à un moment où toutes les organisations internationales que j'ai citées tout à l'heure traversent une midlife crisis, une crise de croissance provoquée par la réalisation soudaine que les missions ont changé avec la fin de la guerre froide. C'est vrai des Nations Unies, qui sont en train de réfléchir à l'évolution de leurs institutions. Et Kemal Darwish, ce matin, a dit très justement un certain nombre de choses sur l'évolution indispensable du Conseil de sécurité. C'est vrai de l'OSCE. Une partie très importante de l'OSCE n'a pas envie que l'OSCE continue, par exemple. Et s'ingénie à compliquer, par le biais de son budget, le devenir même de cette institution qui joue un rôle très important aux marges de l'ancienne Union soviétique. C'est vrai de l'OTAN. Moi, je suis attaché à l'OTAN. Et président de l'Assemblée de l'OTAN, ce n'est pas moi qui vais tirer sur une organisation que je considère essentielle sur la paix du monde. Mais, pardonnez-moi, quelle a été la place de l'OTAN dans les événements graves que nous avons connus depuis le 11 septembre? Nous, Européens, avons fait jouer l'article 5. Est-ce que l'OTAN a joué sur les affaires de terrorisme? Non. Est-ce que l'OTAN a été impliqué dans les affaires post-11 septembre, notamment en Irak? Non. Est-ce que, et j'ai posé cette question à M. Rumsfeld au mois de février dernier à Munich, est-ce que l'OTAN, en tant que structure de consultation, de coopération sur les questions stratégiques entre l'Europe et les États-Unis, est-ce que l'OTAN est compatible avec une doctrine américaine qui fait passer la coalition avant toute autre alliance dans l'exécution d'une mission stratégique? If the mission is a coalition, where is the role for NATO? Cette question, je l'ai posée à M. Rumsfeld, il y a répondu, la mission est la coalition. Si la mission est la coalition, honnêtement, je ne sais pas à quoi sert l'Alliance Atlantique. Et donc la vraie question s'agissant du devenir de l'Alliance Atlantique, c'est quel est le rôle que les États-Unis veulent voir jouer à l'Alliance dans l'après-guerre froide. Regardons maintenant l'Union européenne. Nous, Français, on est payés pour le savoir, puisque une partie du sort de l'Union se joue dimanche dans le référendum français et mercredi dans le référendum hollandais. Vous avez vu l'Union européenne se doter progressivement d'une personnalité politique et stratégique. Et dans la charte, dans le projet de traité constitutionnel, vous trouvez, pour citer M. Kissinger, what telephone number? On lui a donné un numéro de téléphone, on a un président, un ministre des Affaires étrangères, une clause de sécurité collective, une autre clause de sécurité collective en matière de lutte contre le terrorisme, des organes spécialisés en matière de défense, un état-major, un comité des ambassadeurs, et même une agence de l'armement, une liste de missions. La seule chose que les Européens ont oublié de mettre dans leur constitution, c'est des moyens. Et donc, nous avons plein de comités, nous avons plusieurs statuts possibles, il y a même des neutres, la Suède en est un bon exemple, dans l'Union européenne, mais ce qu'il n'y a pas, c'est la volonté de fabriquer une armée commune au-delà de quelques régiments capables de se projeter. Est-ce qu'il est raisonnable pour 450 millions d'Européens de n'avoir de forces disponibles qu'une douzaine de régiments, c'est une vraie question. Donc d'une part, il y a une interrogation sur le devenir de l'OTAN dans la politique américaine. D'autre part, il y a une vraie interrogation sur le devenir de l'Union politique européenne en fonction de la volonté de ses États membres. Une partie de cette réponse est dimanche dans le référendum français. Une autre, c'est dans l'état des budgets de défense à travers toute l'Europe, et notamment en Allemagne et dans d'autres pays. Telle est la réalité. À partir de là, deux points de conclusion. D'abord, en ce qui concerne la nécessité de faire travailler ensemble ces institutions. Il va sans dire que, du point de vue des missions qui sont en face de nous, qui sont des missions humanitaires, qui consistent à sauver des vies, les batailles théologiques n'ont pas lieu d'être. Et je préférerais entendre parler de coordination, de partenariat, plutôt que de compétition entre telle ou telle institution. Comme il a été dit ce matin, très souvent dans les crises que nous avons, et sont de plus en plus des crises internes, nous n'avons pas le temps. Donc ce qu'il faut, c'est éviter les batailles idéologiques et théologiques, organiser cette coopération, si possible, en amont, et faire attention aussi, dans le débat sur soft power, hard power, dans cette affaire de conflits qui sont à la fois des conflits où on a besoin de moyens civils et de moyens militaires, faites attention aux messages que vous donnez aux opinions publiques. À force de parler de soft power, nous n'allons plus avoir de budget de défense du tout dans la plupart des pays occidentaux. Les pays d'Europe aussi et les pays occidentaux ont besoin d'armées capables d'être projetées. Enfin, il faut s'interroger sur toutes ces affaires, sur les problèmes de légitimité internationale, donc le rôle de l'ONU, donc essayer de brancher nos interventions sur la Cour pénale internationale. Alors je sais bien que malheureusement nos amis américains refusent d'adhérer à ce système juridictionnel pourtant pour moi très important. Si les gens qui se livrent au massacre en Ouzbékistan et ailleurs savaient qu'ils deviendraient justiciables devant la Cour pénale internationale, croyez-moi, ça pourrait changer un certain nombre de choses dans la conduite des opérations en matière de sécurité. Enfin, il est important que nous développions à l'intérieur de l'Union des Nations Unies un principe qui permette de s'ingérer dans les affaires intérieures pour éviter les massacres de populations civiles, comme nous le voyons trop souvent. S'agissant, et un tout dernier mot sur ce que nous faisons, nous, Assemblée de l'OTAN, nous n'avons pas de problème métaphysique de coopération avec les différentes organisations. Nous travaillons avec l'ensemble de nos collègues parlementaires et nous travaillons bien. J'étais en Ukraine au mois de décembre dernier pour l'élection de M. Yushchenko et nous faisions ce contrôle électoral sous l'égide de l'OSCE. J'étais en Afghanistan récemment, le président Karzai nous a demandé de participer au monitoring de ces élections. Nous allons le faire avec l'OSCE sans aucun problème et avec l'ONU. Idem pour les élections palestiniennes du 17 juillet où nous allons jouer un rôle. De la même façon, nous n'hésitons pas à travailler sur les sujets difficiles, qu'il s'agisse des Balkans, du Caucase ou du Moyen-Orient. Là encore, sans entrer dans des querelles idéologiques entre l'OTAN, l'Union européenne, les États-Unis. Le principal, c'est d'essayer d'apporter la contribution qui doit être la nôtre le plus vite possible, le plus efficacement possible. J'ai coutume de dire que les députés et les sénateurs membres de l'Assemblée de l'OTAN sont d'abord les ambassadeurs de la démocratie, et c'est ce que nous faisons sans état d'âme. Mais il est de mon devoir, comme président de cette Assemblée, tout de même, de dire que quand on va sur les zones d'opération, on s'aperçoit que ça ne marche pas toujours très bien, qu'il y a souvent un chevauchement des institutions, que c'est souvent très cher et que ça coûte au pays d'accueil. En Afghanistan, par exemple, les ministres afghans ne savent pas qui fait quoi dans leur propre département ministériel. Ça, c'est la réalité. Et que, quelque part, une meilleure coordination de ces organes, peut-être par l'ONU, peut-être par un conseil d'administration, un peacekeeping board, comme il a été proposé ce matin, serait une bonne idée. Et enfin, je voudrais dire que, s'agissant des députés de l'Assemblée de l'OTAN, nous sommes là pour servir et nous le faisons sans état d'âme, dans l'espoir quand même que nos chefs politiques, aussi bien le président des États-Unis pour les États-Unis que les chefs d'État en Europe, définissent assez vite un concept aussi bien pour le devenir de l'OTAN que pour le devenir de l'Union européenne. Pour l'instant, nous sommes dans un flou artistique qui n'est pas optimal par rapport aux tâches qui sont devant nous. Merci de votre attention.
Merci, Monsieur Lusch, pour votre contribution. Now I have Undersecretary for Political Affairs of the Department of State, United States, Mr. Nicholas Burns. Please, Nick. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Minister Ruppel. Can you all hear me? Good. Thank you very much. I thought this was a panel on the Balkans, and it wasn't a panel focusing on the perceived weaknesses or strengths of American foreign policy, but I'm happy to respond to any charges made against us by my good friend Pierre Lelouch. I want to talk about the Balkans. It occurs to me that we have so many talented and experienced people in the room that those of us up here should not monopolize the microphone. We have ministers. We have the Minister of Macedonia here, as well as the Minister of Croatia and Albania. We have all the members of the NAC, my former colleagues, whom I'm delighted to see, and a lot of state secretaries. So I hope that we can be brief and that we can turn this over quickly to a good discussion. I do have a few things to say in the Balkans, but I think I've got to respond to the litany of charges and maybe some of the half-truths put forward about American foreign policy and America's adherence to NATO. The fact is that NATO is going to continue to be, for the United States, the central transatlantic institution. We disagreed profoundly with what Chancellor Schroeder said, what was said on his behalf at the Verekunde Conference. President Bush made it clear when he went to Brussels that NATO is the central transatlantic forum. It's not going to be US-EU relations, the place where the partnership where we talk about our security cooperation. And in fact, it's going to be NATO, because that's where the United States is every day. That's our transatlantic connection. That's the organization that has actually been acting around the world, in Bosnia, in Kosovo in the 90s, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Darfur. And that's the place where I think you'll see the United States put the vast majority of its focus, and that should not be a surprise to anyone. I hope that as we move ahead, we can put behind us this tired old academic argument about what happened or didn't happen in 2001 when NATO invoked Article 5. The fact is that it was the United States that suggested that NATO ought to go into Afghanistan. That was a U.S. suggestion, Pierre. And the fact is that 4 months before the Iraq War, we suggested that NATO go into Iraq. And it was because of a division in the alliance that we couldn't go into Iraq together. But we preferred multilateral action to action with four allies. And now, of course, all of Europe has a chance to join the United States and the United Kingdom and Britain and many other NATO allies to come into Iraq now. And 2005 ought to be the year for that, for people to put their soldiers into Iraq, now that there's an elected government, a sovereign government, a government that truly needs the help of all of Europe. And besides just debating about it, it would be a good thing if countries acted upon that. The largest question when we talk about NATO-EU relations is, what kind of relationship will it be? Will people follow the neo-Gaullist vision of Europe as a counterweight to the United States? Of Europe, of building itself up in opposition to the United States? Or will it be a Europe that truly wants to act in concert to the United States? Over the last 60 years, since the end of the Second World War, Europe chose alliance with the United States, and that brought Europe 60 years of peace. It allowed you 60 years to build the European Union, and without that peace, you could not have done so. And it's given you peace because of the transatlantic umbrella, because of the protection that NATO continues to give this continent. And I'm profoundly reassured by my own 8 years in Europe that the great majority of Europeans do not want this vision of Europe as counterweight to the United States. They want Europe in association with the United States, despite sometimes the disagreements we have, but the fact that we're centered in NATO, the one transatlantic institution that has the capacity to unify us. So my shorthand response to Pierre would be to say that NATO actually is more vigorous now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. We have more soldiers deployed in more missions than we ever did during the Cold War in different places. It is certainly more relevant militarily than it ever was before, and it's the only way you're ever going to be able to truly work with the United States, and that's through NATO. So I'd be happy to debate that with Pierre or others. But let's talk about the Balkans. 10 years ago today, the Balkans wars were the most important worldwide security issue. They were as important in 1995 as Iraq has been to us over the last 2 years. And remember the images. The Bosnian Serbs were on a military offensive, and they were winning. UN peacekeepers were chained to bridges as human shields throughout Bosnia and Herzegovina. And Srebrenica occurred on July 11th and 12th and 13th of 1995 when 8,000 men and boys were murdered in cold blood by General Ratko Mladic, ordered by Radovan Karadzic. That was the image. Those were the images of 10 years ago. What happened? The international community reacted at Lancaster House in London in July, August of 1995 under British leadership and UN leadership. We pulled together and said, enough, enough. And so on August 28th, 29th, and 30th of 1995, NATO struck back at the Bosnian Serbs. And after 2 weeks, we stopped the military offensive. And then we maintained a peace that autumn. We went to the Dayton Peace Conference. We negotiated over 21 days of successful peace, and NATO kept that peace for the last 9 years. And that was NATO's finest hour, and we should be proud of what NATO did. And now we're succeeded by the European Union. We're profoundly grateful that the EU has taken up NATO's role over the last year. In 1999, NATO stepped in and prevented the ethnic cleansing of 1 million Kosovar Albanians, which was morally the right thing to do. And now for the last 6 years, NATO's kept the peace there. I think it's important to remember these images from 1995 and 1999 because they do remind us that the Balkans are vital. After all, the 20th century began with a war in the Balkans in 1912 and 13 that precipitated the Great War, and it ended the 20th century with war in the Balkans in which 250,000 people died and 2.5 million people were made refugees. And what my government is trying to do over the last few weeks is to announce a renewed American commitment to try to help the Balkan people finish the job of building a region of peace. And so we believe very much that 2005 should be a year where we reinvest in Bosnia-Herzegovina to help the people there create one state with a single set of institutions, a single military, and a truly multi-ethnic state that has overcome the terrible divisions of the past. And here there's going to be special responsibility in the Bosnian Serbs to unite with the Bosniaks and the Croats, to put aside the dreams of the past that failed for them, and to find Radovan Karadzic, to arrest him, and to extradite him to The Hague where he has to be, where he has to face justice. And that's obviously our first priority of business. The second priority is to work with Serbia-Montenegro and to bring that very great country back into the family of European and transatlantic nations. Serbia-Montenegro, as well as Bosnia-Herzegovina, should be a member of NATO in the future. But it can't do that unless it deals with its horrible legacy of aggression against its neighbors. And so it has to arrest Ratko Mladic. And we're convinced that Ratko Mladic is in Serbia and that he has been and continues to be supported by elements of the Serb army, not the leadership, but elements of the Serb army. He's guilty of war crimes at Srebrenica. He should be arrested and sent to The Hague. And we can't have a normal relationship with Serbia-Montenegro until that happens. Until that happens. But we're confident that with the fact that 12 Serb citizens have been turned over to The Hague in the last 2 months, we're confident that the government in Belgrade understands that there is really no place for them, certainly not NATO, until they take this very important steps. And then that great nation can put its past behind it, and it can begin to reconstruct itself and engage in the type of reform that Albania and Macedonia and Croatia and all the other countries of that region are presently doing. It needs to catch up with its neighbors and become a normal nation again. And we hope very much for that. And we have profound respect for the government in Belgrade, for what it's trying to do to reform its country. But certainly it has to take this major step to rejoin the European and American family of nations. In Kosovo, we believe that 2005 should be a year of decision where the aspirations of the Kosovar people have to be met at long last after 6 years. And so we very much support the United Nations Secretary General. We hope that by next week he'll have nominated our colleague Kai Ida to become the special United Nations negotiator to conduct an assessment this summer of the standards process and to certify that Kosovo is ready for final status talks. We expect that will be the outcome, but it's up to Kai Ida to determine if that is actually the appropriate step forward. And if it is, then my country will support Kofi Annan and a UN process to convene final status talks this autumn. We think it should be led by a European, senior European politician. We'd be happy to appoint an American diplomat to be deputy to that senior European politician. But we think it's time to get the authorities in Belgrade to sit down with the Kosovar Albanian community and leadership, with the Kosovar Serb leadership, and with the neighbors to Kosovo, and to negotiate the final status of Kosovo itself. We don't think it's for the United States or anyone else to determine what that status is, so we have not supported any specific outcome. But we don't think that people's aspirations for self-rule, for true independence from the affairs of the region and from the wars of the region can be held up forever. And so whatever those people choose, whether it's independence, whether it's continued association with Serbia, Montenegro, whether it's some middle way, they have to be the ones that make that decision, not us. But they have to be given the right to have that process, and we will support it under UN auspices in the autumn. So in these three fronts, completing the job of building a unitary Bosnian state, bringing Serbia, Montenegro back into the family of nations, setting Kosovo in its path to a future that it decides and the Kosovar decides. We think in 2005 all of these things should happen. The U.S. is recommitting itself to the region. We're keeping our troops in Kosovo as part of KFOR. We're enormously proud of what NATO has done in both Bosnia and Kosovo. These are going to be tough negotiations on Kosovo specifically, but we think the time has come to embark in them. Why do we assert this? And why do we assert that the Balkans is still vital and that NATO and the OSCE and the other international institutions should pay attention to the Balkans and be involved? We do because we believe in the aspiration, the great aspiration of the generation of 1989 to 1991, people like Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand and Margaret Thatcher and George H.W. Bush. They said that the great strategic goal of Europe and of my country should be a united, peaceful, stable Europe. And that vision of a Europe that has never existed before but that can be existed in our lifetime can only be realized if the Balkans are part of it. You can't have the Balkans fester as an island of instability and violence and expect Europe to be free and united and stable. And so that's why we support a final status process for Kosovo and a redemptive reform process for Serbia and Montenegro and a future unitary state in Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And that's also why we support Macedonia and Albania and Croatia as future members of our alliance. I had the great pleasure to meet with the three ministers yesterday, and they are working very hard to meet the requirements of NATO membership. We want to see them become members of NATO. And as soon as all those requirements are met, we will support them. And I'm sure other countries will as well. And when they take their place in NATO, they will be an example to Belgrade and to Pristina and to Sarajevo of what their future is, the future of those latter three countries, and what can happen for them if they reform and believe in democracy and believe that war is not the answer and inter-ethnic hatred is not the answer. So I'm happy to contribute those thoughts. I apologize for going longer than I thought I would, Mr. Minister, but I look forward to a good conversation with everyone in this room.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador. I really enjoyed your speech. The third speaker is Kolinda Grabar-Kitarović, who is Minister of Foreign Affairs of Croatia. Please, Kolinda.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I will join everyone else in thanking our Swedish host for the excellent organization of this event. Coming from Croatia, of course, I will concentrate on the region of Southeastern Europe or Western Balkans and try to give a contribution from the position of a country that's going through a double process of transition, like the other Eastern European countries, from a centrally planned to a market economy, but also from a country that was just recently affected by war and aggression against its people and territory, but it's today firmly on the way towards a future in the European Union and finalizing, resolving the issues that were left from the recent conflict. In the area of Southeastern Europe, there is a number of initiatives, and they have all undoubtedly contributed to the stabilization of the region. However, I will concentrate on the Euro-Atlantic process, Euro-Atlantic integration process, because I believe that it offers the best possibilities and the best incentives for the region. First of all, I strongly agree with Nick Burns that the prospect of integration of Southeastern Europe in the European Union is the only way to have a lasting stability and peace in the region, but also to have a Europe whole free and at peace, as your president said. But also, this process serves as a very strong incentive to all the countries in the region that by fulfilling the criteria for membership, they reform their own countries, their own governments, their own societies, and helps them as a catalyst, as a very strong catalyst that sets before each of our countries a strong, a firm, a determined agenda aimed at positioning our countries as exemplary European democracies, as strong market societies, but also countries that care about people, that care about neighborhood, and that care about the stability of the region, of Europe, and of course, of global stability as well. The overall security situation in Southeast Europe today looks more favorable if compared to the past decade. A lot has been done, and to a large extent that has been a result of the activities and reforms undertaken in the framework of Euro-Atlantic institutional cooperation. In this context, we must commend the positive influence of the Partnership for Peace, which Croatia, by the way, joined on this day 5 years ago, especially through the NATO membership action plan, as well as the EU process of stabilization and association in the area of Southeastern Europe, for which I would say is one of the successes of the European Common Foreign and Security Policy. These mechanisms, together with the perspective of a future EU and NATO membership, have proven to be, as I said, the best catalyst for the countries in Southeastern Europe to implement comprehensive political, economic, and institutional reforms. All Southeast European countries are involved in the process of stabilization and are oriented towards the realization of a society with developed market, democratic and market-oriented standards, to the rule of law, Euro-Atlantic integration, as well as to achieving good neighborly relations. And cooperation in the neighborhood is not only an obligation that arises from our aspirations to become members of the Euro-Atlantic institutions. It's really in the best interest of every single country in Southeastern Europe, because the image of the region very much affects the image of every single country and very much contributes to the overall security situation and, of course, the economic prospects of each country. However, of course, the degree of stability differs from one country to another and should be evaluated taking into account the specific situation in every country individually. Lasting constitutional and political arrangements, which should provide for political and economic stability and security in this region, have not, in some states, assumed the final form, such as Serbia, Montenegro, Kosovo, or these arrangements have outlived their original purpose and goal, such as in Bosnia and Herzegovina. High unemployment, underdeveloped economies and infrastructure, the absence of efficient legal and administrative mechanisms, corruption and organized crime, poor social prospects and low standards of living are holding back the development of economic and social self-sustainability of some states of the region. Regional cooperation is an important component of stability. This cooperation should be forward-looking, based on common Euro-Atlantic aspirations. In this context, open issues should be settled, such as the return of refugees and displaced persons, missing persons, the responsibility for war crimes, settling property issues, etc. in that regard, let me point out the role of the OSCE in the context of the refugee return. The very important trilateral Sarajevo Agreement on Comprehensive Return of Refugees signed between Croatia, Serbia, and Montenegro in Bosnia and Herzegovina, with a goal to settle these issues until the end of 2006, which sets a definite time framework. But also the role that Dmitry has mentioned in monitoring the war crimes that our own judiciary will be taking over from the ICTY. For us, it's an issue of utmost importance, not only to begin negotiations, to open accession negotiations with the European Union, but to close this chapter. The ICTY for us is a legal means of establishing individual guilt for war crimes, to avoid the mistakes that were made in the past of putting collective guilt on entire nations and ethnic groups. And also for us, it's also the means of resolving the issues of final normalization of relations and to provide really conditions for human security of every single individual who returns to the place of their origin. And in this way, I would really commend the role of the OSCE, of the European Commission, and of everyone else who is participating in this process. Croatia, of course, shares the same goals as the ICTY, and we hope that the last remaining issue that we have will be resolved soon in the mutual interest and based on the mutual agenda. Croatia strongly supports its neighbors, Serbia and Montenegro and Bosnia and Herzegovina, in joining the PFP. However, of course, we insist that the same conditions are fulfilled and that there are no exceptions in that regard. We also participate in the NATO program for facilitating the defense reforms in Serbia and Montenegro. Let me underline the example of a very successful trilateral cooperation between Croatia, Albania, and Macedonia in the framework of the U.S. Adriatic Charter, which will shortly result with sending a joint medical team in Afghanistan, which also provides us with a forum to discuss very specific issues, the problems that we have, and how we can assist each other in resolving the problems encountered on the way to NATO membership. Our active engagement in the regional initiatives and processes such as the Stability Pact, the Adriatic Charter, Adriatic Ionian Initiative, the Quadrilaterale, say, etc., will continue and grow. And Croatia wants to continue assuming the role of responsibility of being, in a way, a role model and in encouraging the reformist forces in the neighboring countries as well by showing by its own example that the effort that you invest at home in the proper reform will be followed by the appropriate steps on this way to EU and NATO membership as well. Now to go to some specific problems in the neighborhood, Kosovo. The Kosovo problem remains a very sensitive and important issue for security and stability in the Central Balkans, although thanks to the international community's involvement, it does not pose a danger for wider destabilization. There is some encouraging progress regarding meeting of standards, yet it still falls short when it comes to the return of refugees, the integration of Serb and other ethnic minorities, and particularly in securing the participation of the Kosovo Serbs within the Kosovo political structures. We are expecting the international evaluation of the standards. And regarding the status issue, we fully share the position that there can be no return to the situation prior to 1999 and that the solution for Kosovo must be European in its nature in terms of ensuring democratic development, human and minority rights, effective government, regional stability and prosperity, and the integration perspective for the region. We will support the results achieved in direct negotiations between Belgrade and Pristina with the active participation of the international community. And in that regard, the common endeavors of the EU and the US are imperative. The process of negotiations on status issue must pay full respect to the territorial integrity of the neighboring states. Serbia and Montenegro. We're aware of the advances made within Serbia and Montenegro regarding market reforms and the latest positive development regarding Serbia's cooperation with the ICTY and the Ovčara crime court process in Belgrade. We are concerned, however, that the reform-minded democratic forces are not overwhelmingly strong and are internally divided in Serbia, and that the reform processes are weak. The results of the radical party are particularly worrisome, and its policies are potentially destabilizing for Serbia and its neighborhood. The structure and functioning of the central government remains dysfunctional and points to the practical existence of the two separate systems within the country. It is up to Belgrade and Podgorica to resolve the issue of creating a functional federation or a functional separation with the respect of existing legal regulation and international standards. Still, in our opinion, this issue is not of wider security consequence. Bosnia and Herzegovina. Advancing the internal legal and political system defined by the Dayton Accords is the basis for the further development of Bosnia and Herzegovina. This reform should ensure autonomous, functioning, and efficient decision-making in respect to state governance and should contribute to the consolidation of economic sustainability of the country. High administrative levels and overexpensive state that the economy is unable to sustain, as well as different concepts of the country's main political parties concerning the constitution and political development of the country, are slowing down the path of reform and the Euro-Atlantic integration process. A clear Euro-Atlantic perspective for Bosnia and Herzegovina would encourage and act as an impetus for the development of a modern, democratic, multicultural, and multi-ethnic state. To ensure such development, Bosnia and Herzegovina should carry out the outlined reforms that are a precondition for signing the stabilization and association agreement with the EU. The Croatian policy towards Bosnia and Herzegovina is guided by respect of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. We are hopeful that the progress Bosnia and Herzegovina has made in meeting the European criteria, especially cooperation with the ICTY, will open the way to the start of the negotiations on the stabilization and association agreement before the end of this year, as well as for Bosnia and Herzegovina's inclusion within the PFP as soon as possible. We are of the opinion that the international community, and particularly the EU, should, within the process of integration negotiations, encourage the reforms intended to strengthen the central government and the equality of the three constituent peoples of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Croatia's relationship with the EU and NATO. Croatia gained the status of a candidate country for European membership last year, which makes Croatia, according to the EU's own accession criteria, the most advanced country in the region in that respect. Croatia's relations with the Southeast European countries and furthering of regional cooperation are one of our foreign policy priorities and strategic goals. Peace, stability, and prosperity in the neighborhood are of our vital interest. Croatia, as a full-fledged member in the future of the EU and NATO, will be able to act as an external anchor of stability and the catalyst of democratic development in the countries of Southeast Europe. We have already taken our share of responsibility and actively promote such development in the region. A few years ago, Croatia started to exchange its experience in the Euro-Atlantic integration with the countries from the region. The ever-increasing bilateral as well as regional cooperation among our police and justice officials in combating transnational organized crime and terrorism serve as an example of good neighborly relations. And finally, a few words on the prospects for the region. I would say that the Southeast Europe is at a historical crossroads. The chances for a historical breakthrough towards European standards and Euro-Atlantic integration are colliding with unsettled ethnic, political, and other issues. Croatia firmly believes that the answers to these questions should be sought only through peaceful means in the spirit and on the basis of European standards. The prospects of admission to the Euro-Atlantic integration process and the acceptance of its standards as a foundation for building modern states is crucial to the stabilization and democratic development of Southeastern Europe. These prospects for each individual country in the region will provide additional motivation and strengthen enthusiasm for the development of democratic standards, human rights, and the creation of a positive climate for the economic and general development of society. In joining the Euro-Atlantic integration process, it is essential that all countries of the region have the political will, the vision, and leadership to meet Euro-Atlantic standards. It takes time to achieve results, but the results will come if the process is right. The admission of the southeastern European countries into the Euro-Atlantic integration process on the basis of their individual merits and achievements will result in, first, the extension of the European Stability Zone. Individual admission of each country is a step towards closing the security gap in the underbelly of Europe. Secondly, in the encouragement for enthusiasm towards further reforms. And thirdly, in the assistance to the EU and the international community for their activities in the region. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Colinda. So this is this exhausts the list of speakers. Now we have three distinguished discussants. The first of them will be Kastriot Islami, Foreign Minister of Albania. Kastriot, please.
Thank you, Dimitri. Can you hear me? Dear friends, first of all, I will be focused very briefly on the Western Balkans. And before starting, I have to thank very much Colinda that we are mainly sharing the same view and opinions and estimation on the region, and working very closely with Croatia and Macedonia, especially in the framework of Adriatic Charter, with the aim to become as soon as possible or to get the invitation for the NATO membership. But I cannot start without thanking very much Undersecretary Burns for very comprehensive approach, not including thoughts, but also concrete steps in this year and the next year for our region. Myself, I can gladly say that compared with the Balkans of only a decade ago, one should straightly affirm that the overall security landscape in the southeastern Europe, and particularly in the Western Balkans, is radically changing. One has to agree that it comes mainly because the countries of the region are changing, while we cannot forget the importance of the prompt and effective intervention and assistance of the international organization time and again. Nevertheless, let me say that we share the same view that such a huge qualitative change could never have become a tangible reality without a continued cooperation and concerted action among the international actors operating in the region, inter alia the UN, the OSCE, the Council of Europe, the EU, NATO, etc. on one side, and the governments of the host countries of the region on the other side. Despite this, it is imperative for us to embrace a more cohesive approach, which would consist in a well-coordinated need of acting together and complementing each other in line with international community. The results obtained in the course of past years by acting in concert all together indicate unity of purpose and action. We are proud to witness great progress in the area of fulfilling the needed criteria which led to the irreversible path of Euro-Atlantic integration. The Adriatic Charter, Albania, Croatia and Macedonia in particular, is an excellent example of our successful concerted efforts, which has to be broadened and followed by others. Other important harmonizing factors which play a leading role in our concerted efforts are CSCP, Stability Pact, but also free trade agreements, regional power interconnection, regional private banking system, etc. In this perspective, we would ask for more attention, concrete and effective intervention by the international community, in particular European Union, in encouraging important financing institutions to back projects and programs at the regional level. Analyzing these various stages of democratic development in the region, we commend warmly the positive political accomplishment of our neighbors and partners toward integration. Inter alia, the signing of the Treaty for Accession in EU for Bulgaria and Romania, the ongoing negotiation for membership of Croatia, the progress achieved by Macedonia in its last application, and the fulfillment of conditions for opening negotiation in Serbia and Montenegro and Bosnia and Herzegovina. Albania itself is seriously engaged in this process and has already obtained optimistic results as far as our obligation and completion of required reforms towards signing the Association Stabilization Agreement is concerned. Besides that, my country represents precursor of friendly relations with all the countries in the region, both at bilateral and at a multilateral level, searching to promote confidence building and a regional approach for further integration. Dear colleagues, I would like at this point to draw your attention upon Kosovo and its perspective. I believe you would agree with me on the fact that the future development in Kosovo remains the most challenging issues ahead for us in terms of stability and security for the whole region. One could not deny the significant progress it has been made over the last year towards the fulfillment of the standards. We strongly believe that the start of standards evaluation process by mid-2005 would lead to the commencement of negotiation for the future status of Kosovo within 2005, based on the principle of democratic and multi-ethnic society, including the return of displaced persons. We don't have a formula for the final status, but we think that for the moment being there are three elements which has a large consensus: no return 99, no division, no unification, and I can add also no status quo, and maybe it's just time for giving more freedom to the people of Kosovo for deciding for their future status and their European future. There is no doubt that the Europeanization of the Western Balkans, timely inclusion of Bosnia and Herzegovina and Serbia and Montenegro in the Partnership for Peace and the process of association stabilization by respecting the IHTI, the determination of future of status of Kosovo, would confidently be a decisive step forward in the consolidation of the stability, peace and the security in our region. I think that the significant achievements and progress attained should not lead us to euphoria as we face other non-conventional threats to the regional security and stability, such as terrorism, organized crime, corruption, illegal trafficking, etc. In this respect, something we have done. Much more should be done in terms of cooperation and coordination of our actions and international organizations specialized in the area, NATO included. It's my good feeling and perception that we all have understood that to win the final battle, we need to foster cooperation and solidarity among us and our strategic international partners, mainly NATO, EU, OSCE, and other fora. Let me finally conclude by affirming that the security and stability for my country, the Western Balkans, the Southeastern Europe, and beyond remain our unchangeable prerogative, because it relies on the irreversibility of the European integration underway and on our commitment for acting in concert as guarantors and contributors of security, peace and progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. Now we have two more discussants. First is James Ellis, and the last will be Nicholas White, and then we shall have, I hope, some meaningful discussion. Mr. Ellis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will take no longer than 5 minutes. In the European Parliament, we normally only have two, so this is a real pleasure for me. I would first, as a short comment, I'm delighted to be back in ERA with the Swedish hosts. I did come here 2 years ago. I went to the top of the mountain, and then the Swedish host said, "Would you like to paraglide down?" And I said, "Why not?" So I've seen the town of ERA from the air, but I can assure you that I'm not likely to repeat the paragliding experience in the short time. That gives me, though, I think, three things, though, to say in this debate. Firstly, is the general context, because I'd like to comment, Nick, on the "and elsewhere" in the title. I think there's sufficient experience on the Balkans, and I don't want to go into that area. In the general context, huge changes have occurred in the last 15 years in the relations between the different institutions. CSIS had a brilliant think tank summit, which was part supported by NATO last month in Y, which I contributed to. Three specific things are worth looking at. Number one is the comments by Bob Hunter, who is saying, well, what's the fuss here between NATO and the EU? We've got a very broad basis for cooperation. And he did clarify Schroeder's remarks as saying it's not a question that he doesn't want the fact that NATO is no longer the primary thing. It just doesn't happen, and that therefore he would like to see an improvement, I think, in that context. Secondly, a contribution by Christoph Bertram, who underlined three elements which have changed fundamentally since 1989 in NATO. Number one is it's an alliance without limits, therefore enlargement and enlargement. Secondly, it's the globalization of the issues, of the shift from threats to global risks. And thirdly, is the emergence of the EU as a player. And it comes up with one or two suggestions. But equally, there's a third contribution by Jim Dobbins, which is a brilliant contribution to what the wise men might say, if there were wise men around to give a view, about how the UN could focus more on post-conflict stabilization, how we might have stronger NATO-EU ties, and indeed on the EU-US dimension, and it's that which I'd like now to focus on. The issues have indeed become more global. It's no error in thinking that economics, as we heard a little bit earlier this morning, is tied to security. We have the questions of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, the questions in the Middle East, China, environmental demographic change. These are issues where the European Union is a major policy maker and therefore needs to be included, because for me, the context in which we're working post-Cold War is that there's a linkage between economics, politics, and security policy to which the institutions need to adjust. And therefore, to the EU-US dimension, there's a wonderful opportunity at next month's EU-US summit on the 20th of June to take three specific steps forward, nothing radical, but to build on what exists. Because as Kissinger said in Brussels 2 weeks ago, we now have a telephone number, but we need to now know what we have to say. What is the common agenda? And the first one here is on the economic side, not a subject perhaps normally mentioned in NATO, but certainly, of course, in the EU, where the businesses on both sides of the Atlantic are waiting for a green light to complete the transatlantic market. The OECD will report in the next couple of days that this could bring an increase of income per capita on both sides of the Atlantic to 1 to 2.5%. That, I'm told by American experts, is a $900 tax cut, which could be very useful in terms of economic management, but also, I think, useful for us on this side of the Atlantic. A Commission communication last week has endorsed this approach of a barrier-free transatlantic market. Secondly, this won't happen without the involvement of the political communities on both sides, and by that I mean European parliamentarians and the US Congress. It may be that you would think that there aren't any contacts there, but last week I was part of a presidency group of my political group, the biggest group in the European Parliament of the centre-right. We now have a regular annual dialogue with the Republican Senate Policy Committee, so from Bill Frist downwards, there is a real interest by senators to have an ongoing dialogue on issues, whether it be helping young Iranians for democracy, whether it happens to be on energy, or whether it happens to be on assistance to Afghanistan, where the anti-drugs campaign seems to have not progressed sufficiently strongly. And a therefore involvement of politicians. So thirdly, it means that we have to relook at the process of the new transatlantic agenda, linking the EU and the US, not to remove it, not to radicalize it, but to build on it, to include the political communities, and to develop, if you like, a real partnership. And therefore I conclude, Mr. Chairman, in these thinkings of how the general context has changed, the issues have changed, the EU-US, if you ask anybody, even Kissinger, said that we now have to address our minds to what we do with this particular problem. I believe that if it's enhanced at the June summit on the 20th of June, not only will it help us in Europe understand better the US agenda of freedom and democracy, to which I think not only do we have to respond, but we have to participate in. Secondly, I think it'll ease the frictions within NATO and between NATO and the EU if the EU and the US understand each other better in a context of bilateral action. And last and not least, on a general political level, to think that you can have better economic well-being and sense of means of partnership between the peoples of America and Europe will mean not only will we actually really work together in the 21st century, but that NATO will continue to exist and be seen to be relevant by both sides of the Atlantic.
Thank you. Now we have Mr. Nicholas White, Director of the European Programme of the International Crisis Group. Please, Nicholas.
Thank you, Minister, and thanks very much to Jamie Shea, his colleagues from the EAPC Task Force, and to our hosts for organising this excellent conference. I'm conscious that I am the only non-official speaking on this panel, so I'm sure you haven't come here to listen to me. I have six thoughts, which I'll try and share with you in 5 minutes, and then we can move on to the discussion. I have three thoughts on the Balkans and three thoughts on the elsewhere a bit. My first thought is that the EU perspective on the whole has worked. We see now that it has worked very well for Bosnia-Herzegovina and for Macedonia. We see that these countries are now very, very close to achieving the next steps in the European integration process. That's of great importance. My organisation published a briefing yesterday on Serbia, arguing that the policy of conditionality has worked, that saying to people, these are the conditions you must fulfil before you can take the next step, is a clear, comprehensible policy, and that it has delivered results in Serbia, particularly in the last few months. The consequence of this is that Croatia must get real about delivering General Gotovina. The consequence of this also is that Albania must deliver free and fair elections in July. But this is a clear message that has come clearly from the international community, from the EU and the US over the last few years. My second thought is on Kosovo and Kosovo final status. I very much welcome the report that's been submitted by Kofi Annan and by Søren Jessen Petersen to the UN Security Council this week, which it seems is likely to trigger the next steps of which Nick Burns spoke earlier. I also welcome Nick Burns' own statement last week that the final status is going to come somewhere between the Serbian position of less than independence and the Albanian position of immediate unconditional independence. I hope I've read the nuances there correctly. I hope I don't read too much into the fact that you didn't use quite the same words this morning. But I was glad to see that. I think we should be realistic about what Kosovo's post-status situation is going to be. We shouldn't look to repeat the Bosnia experience of the High Representative. The situation is very different. We shouldn't look to bring in an EU protectorate. We shouldn't look to perpetuate the UNMIC administration in a different form. What we're going to need is accountable local institutions which are subject to intensive international mentoring and monitoring. But that's not quite the same thing. My third thought on the Balkans is also a thought on the immediate agenda for Kosovo, not what we do next month, but what should be done now. We're producing another report later this week, which will contain three main recommendations to the international community. First of all, that the parallel security structures operated by Kosovo political parties should be dissolved. These are acting as impediments on democratisation and impediments on Kosovo's political process. Secondly, that the international community should relax a little bit on the decentralisation of local government. It's very slow to do this in a normal country. Kosovo is not a normal country. And what's needed is a political commitment to the process. Looking for concrete results at this stage, I think, is going to be counterproductive. And thirdly, that Kosovars need help to work out their own position on the final status negotiations. It's a deeply divided society politically, and you know, those who follow the situation closely have seen what the recent political dialogue has been like. It's going to require friendly international assistance, and we'll be there, but we're not the only people who can do that. My three thoughts on the wider picture are this. First of all, that sometimes we should be a bit creative in the way we approach these things. I noticed that although everybody has said that they're very satisfied with the current institutional architecture, none of the other speakers on this panel has mentioned the Stability Pact for Southeastern Europe. 5 years, I beg your pardon, 5 years ago, everybody would have been mentioning it. I think that shows that sometimes things have changed. And with all due respect to the chairman, the OSCE, despite its engagement in Transnistria, South Ossetia and Nagorno-Karabakh, hasn't actually a great deal to show for that. And let's not forget that those structures were erected, 15 years ago, at a time when the European Union was half its present size, at a time before Europe actually had a telephone number, which is Brussels 285-6111, for those of you who need it. But, I mean, of course we shouldn't go forum shopping, but perhaps sometimes a strategic rethink is appropriate, given the changing role of EU integration, given the changing role of the EU. My second thought on this is that since this is a NATO meeting, essentially, let's not get hung up on the EU-NATO theology. The EU's military tasks are going to be largely restricted to the Petersburg tasks in the foreseeable future, which means that for the heavy lifting, it is going to be NATO if anybody does it. And I must say, although I'm not close to this debate, I've interpreted the debates over who should do what in Darfur really as an excuse for not getting involved rather than as an excuse for getting involved. I welcome, of course, the recent developments with the Africa Union summit and what's going to happen in Addis Ababa this week. But I have to say the timescale of response is not impressive. We've been warning about this situation for the last 12 months, and now we're seeing concerted international action. I suppose that's always the role of the NGO. My final thought is on how we can resolve conflicts more effectively in future. I think there are two crucial elements to this. The first is early and sustained international engagement. Again, fine that the internationals have finally got the Balkans right, but it took 3 years in the early 1990s for that to happen. But it also requires good and timely information. Our role as a non-governmental organisation is to urge the former and to provide the latter. And we'll continue to do this, and I look forward to working with all of you in that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, here we are at the end of the official list of speakers and discussants. And now the discussion can start. I have already one contribution announced, and this is Minister of Foreign Affairs of Macedonia, Ilinka Mitreva. Would you like to say something, Ilinka? Please.
Are you going to? Okay. Minister Rupel, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to briefly share with you the experience of the Republic of Macedonia as a country that has been subject to the effects of the institutional cooperation we are discussing today. If I have to make a general assessment of the cooperation and coordination of the significant number of international contributors that were in one form or another present in Macedonia during and after the crisis in 2001, I believe I will not make a mistake if I use the word remarkable. And there were quite a few dimensions of cooperation and coordination. There was institution-to-institution cooperation, such as the one among NATO, EU, OSCE, and UN. Then there was the nation-to-nation aspect of the cooperation, mainly between United States and the EU member states. Of course, I cannot exclude the civilian-military cooperation, which every so often tends to be a rather complex relationship. But I will argue that aside from the significance of the lessons learned during previous missions in the region, the Macedonian success story was primarily a result of another immensely important dimension. And that was the extraordinary cooperation of the international community or factors with the government, the institutions, and the citizens of the Republic of Macedonia, built on the basis of mutual trust. Because even though there was excellent strategic coordination among the international actors, which in our case indeed spoke with one voice, it was the Macedonian government and institutions that assumed responsibility for all the difficult decisions, and you are all aware of the significance of the Ohrid Framework Agreement. It was the government of the Republic of Macedonia and the institutions of the system that proved their ability and capacity to handle even the toughest challenges they were confronted with. And you know that our achievements in this regard speak for themselves. In addition, it was precisely the cooperation with the international institutions and especially the numerous aspects of cooperation with NATO and the EU that was highly beneficial in enhancing our Euro-Atlantic integration process. The support and counsel we received from Brussels and from the NATO and EU member countries were an exceptional supplement to our individual efforts in achieving the membership standard. So, dear friends, dear ladies and gentlemen, just 4 years after the crisis, the Republic of Macedonia is today rightfully expecting an invitation for membership to the Alliance by the end of this year, the status of candidate country for EU membership. Consequently, I believe that both the Republic of Macedonia and the international community have every right to be proud of what we have achieved so far. Of course, I would argue that we must always be careful while utilizing the lessons learned from previous missions. We must always be aware of the risks of becoming victims or even prisoners of habitual thinking and templates. Therefore, as our previous experience so clearly demonstrates, the institutional cooperation or acting in concert has to be imaginative and resourceful in each and every future case around the world. For if we know that the unexpected always happens, we cannot just create experience. We must undergo it, and we know that the experience is a hard teacher because she gives the test first and the lessons afterwards. But we apparently seem to be excellent students. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Minister. Did you expect an answer from the panel?
Tout à l'heure, j'ai parlé à Monsieur Lelouch et je lui ai raconté l'histoire qui vient d'une de mes dernières visites de ma circonscription. I was running for the last parliamentary elections in the former crisis area. This is, and I think the half of the panelists know very well where were the former crisis areas, Tisztetov, Gosztivar, and Debar. And then I was witness of personal drama and tensions and sad stories. Now, when I'm paying visit to my constituency, meeting people, they are very severely criticizing the government because of the lack of the jobs, because of the lack of the visa, because of the lack of a better standard of living. They forgot in only 3 years that in 2001 the main question was stability and security. So we should be proud of what we have achieved in Macedonia.
So I shall not ask you once more whether this was a question or something else. Now I give the floor to András Bárcsony from Hungary, please.
Thank you very much, Dmitry. The second sentence of the title of the panel, how can institutional cooperation make the world more secure? Definitely not in a way if member or participating countries represent different positions in different international organizations. Because the debate among, or the discussion, or sometimes even the dispute among international organizations, which is obviously led by secretariats, but not different because of the position of the secretariats, but we can, and you most probably will agree with me, Dmitry, that how many times we faced, at least on the European scene, in different organizations, same countries representing different positions on the same issue. That's one element, and that is a very urging signal. No, this is, I'm talking about European scenes, definitely. Secondly, I'm a bit disappointed, to be very frank, because this is a security forum, and we spend today at least 1 hour discussing the issues of Serbia-Montenegro related issues, Bosnia-Herzegovina related issues, and I remember my very distinguished panelists, friends, how disappointed they were 2-3 years ago when issues related their own country's perspectives were discussed without them. And now here we are, that we are discussing issues where certain opponent positions are not mentioned or could be not mentioned because the representatives of those countries are not here. But even we can easily criticize or comment Mr. Ashdown's excellent job in this way, and he has no opportunity to discuss such a question on a forum. This is not an organization, this is a forum. So it would be better to go on this way. Last but not least, and Certainly, this is one of the key elements for the future of the Balkan. I'm definitely convinced that as long as there will be more conditional position for Serbia, Montenegro, or for Bosnia Herzegovina than certain countries in this partnership council from other regions, which we all cover, that is not very inspiring for those countries. I tell this because yesterday we have been talking about Central Asian issues and we were criticizing certain countries. And I'm really convinced that when we are talking about democracy, human rights, even though that there are existing problems in Serbia, Montenegro, maybe in Bosnia and Herzegovina, but these countries, at least not less developed on the way of democracy than certain participating countries in this partnership council. And the question for us is whether we have single standards on our own way. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. This was a very complex contribution, full of riddles, so only our friend Nick Burns can answer this.
Thank you for the other.
Thank you for the compliment, backhanded, whether well or not. I would just like to say two things in answer to what you said, State Secretary. First is that the reason that there are no representatives of Serbia, Montenegro here, or Bosnia Herzegovina, is because there was no consensus to invite them, and my country was against inviting them. We were against inviting them to dinner last night, but we're happy to have them here. Why is that? Because at Reykjavik 3 years ago, we decided that these countries would not have access to the Partnership for Peace and to these meetings unless they met the requirements, which were arrest Mladic, arrest Karadzic. Those are the two people who brought us and you the 2.5 million refugees and 250,000 people dead between 1991 and 1995, and Srebrenica. And there's a NATO policy that they don't participate in the official sessions of the EAPC unless they meet those requirements. We believe that policy is working. The Republika Srpska understands that it's going to be continued, it'll be isolated in Banja Luka unless they take the step of finding Karadzic, and Belgrade certainly understands that, and they're beginning to respond, and we ought to maintain the pressure on them until they do. This is an official NATO decision, which we think is the right decision.
Thank you, Ambassador. Please.
Thank you. Sven Jerzhevski, I'm with the Canadian Embassy in Zagreb. And so perhaps a point of view from the coalface, as it were. I was a little disappointed, quite frankly, that Kemal Dervish's equation of politics, economics, and security was not taken up. Is this thing on?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Was not taken up. What we got from the panelists was high strategy, the architecture, the institutional architecture, and the need to adjust it. Now, certainly that's true, and that needs doing, and it's been a work in progress for some time. But in order to provide for stability at the regional and domestic level requires taking Dervish's equation seriously, and I haven't heard a word about that here. It's a shift from strategy to the minutiae of how do we help governments to be stable, to engage in reform. Let me give one example. There is very little investment in the real economy in Croatia. As a result, unemployment is very, very high. On official statistics, a restrictive ILO definition, unemployment is 14.5. On more liberal, more general statistics, it's over 20%. And youth employment reaches 30%. That's not a strong basis for labor market liberalization or other reforms that will carry Croatia forward. But no investment is taking place. And this is for a host of institutional reasons relating to the policies of various international organizations that have an impact on Croatia. Is there coordination between these institutions on these questions? No, at least not from my perspective on the ground in Zagreb. How do we achieve that? Efforts by the World Bank, even in such simple matters as coordinating expenditures, projects in producing judicial reform, have not been successful. We need mechanisms. We need pushes from governments and from institutions in order to affect that, in order to help the Croatian government go forward with a program of reform. What's the result of all of this? The result of all of this is that support, public support, for entry into the Union and accession to NATO is falling. When I arrived 2 years ago, 80% of the population was in favor of accession to the Union, number close to that to NATO. Now we're below 50%, depends on the poll, for the Union, and around 45% for NATO. One has to be practical. It would have been a good idea, for example, to have held this seminar in Zagreb. It would have done much to inform the local population and media of NATO's interest in Croatia. Instead, we're in Sweden. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was a very
organized conference. Thank you.
I thank you very much for your comment. Perhaps Kolinda would like to say something to that.
Yes, thank you very much. I would agree it's a really good point. And, of course, when you give a presentation, you're always limited by time. But the economic and social aspects, and this is when I briefly mentioned that it will help countries to invest not only in political but also economic reforms and the stabilization of the markets, the social issues, etc. For Croatia, it's been a difficult path because we have mostly invested from the state budget in the realization of the political and all the other goals. For instance, when it comes to the return of refugees, that is basically financed from the state budget. So on the one hand, you have the World Bank and the IMF asking for the budget to be balanced. And on the other hand, you have the political priorities that you realize that you have to finance and that you want to conclude by the end of 2006. The second very important issue in this is really taking care that we provide conditions for sustainable development in the areas where refugees are returning. Because if people are going back and there are no prospects for jobs, then of course it will be one of the discouraging elements. And this, in my opinion, is one of the reasons why not all persons who have fled some of the areas of Croatia will return to their houses, in addition to the fact that in the meantime they have found jobs and lives elsewhere. I think that the point that was made is something that we all should work on and really in the context of the so-called human security, because the security of the people who return and of conflict prevention and post-conflict dealing is not only the absence of physical fighting, but it's conditions for social security, for health protection, for education, for jobs and prosperity. And that is for countries difficult to do on their own. Croatia has been beneficiary of the CARDS program, which is aimed at the countries of the stabilization and association process. But it's mostly institution building. And now we have become beneficiary of the pre-accession funding of the European Union, the three major funds whereby we'll make investments in the infrastructure, again, in the institution building, the agricultural development, etc. But what is important for Croatia is, since the areas that were affected by war were underdeveloped even before the war, is to have the strategies for economic development of all the regions. So it's a huge task, it's a huge burden for us, and we are dealing with it. And I think that what is important is that we're very much willing to share this experience, what we have gained in the process, the mistakes that we have made, and the options that can can be made is to share that with our neighboring countries as well, and in that way to contribute to the stability and the sustainable development of the region as well.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you very much. I'm Bogdan Mazuru. I'm the ambassador of Romania to NATO. And I want just to make a very brief comment on what something that Pierre Lelouch said. That's something that I feel a little bit unfair, which is that NATO is in search for the missions. And I think that it's better to say, and it's more fair to say, that the missions are in search for NATO. And if we look at the missions in which NATO is engaged in right now, in Afghanistan, and we had a request from President Karzai to come and support Afghanistan. If we look at Iraq, we got a letter from Prime Minister at that time, Alawi, to ask NATO to come to help. If we look now in Darfur, we have a request coming from Konari and from the United Nations. So I think that it's better to say that NATO is an organization that is not demanding for missions, but the missions are demanding more for NATO. And this is a sign, as Undersecretary Burns said, I think this is a sign of vitality. And this is a sign that NATO is in a better shape now and is at least as useful now than it was some 15 years ago or before 1990. So I just wanted to make this brief remark to put things in order. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Monsieur Lelouch, vous allez le rendre.
I want to reply to you that when I see, and this is where I fully agree with Nick Burns, when I see what we have accomplished in the Balkans, with now the EU continuing the work in Bosnia, I feel proud of the alliance. And I feel proud of our soldiers, and I feel proud of the fact that, for example, it was the French officer who runs integrated NATO operation in Kosovo today. It's not easy. Similarly, when I go to Afghanistan and I see our soldiers and I talk to the president, I'm proud of the fact that all of us, we are doing this job in Afghanistan. What I'm saying, so when we are on the ground and we do the job, including the French forces, I am completely confident that the job is done and it's done properly. On the other hand, we should not delude ourselves with the fact that, you know, the topic this morning was to discuss whether these institutions were working correctly together. In many ways, they not always do that. A great deal of confusion in many countries, and we know that. So there's no point in hiding it. Second, if you look at the way NATO actually operates and the difficulty of the Secretary General or the guys in charge to get sufficient means to do the mission, national caveats, finding the proper number of helicopters and means to do the mission. Many times I have the feeling that, you know, the mission comes, we are there. There is, in fact, not necessarily a strategic agreement between the parties as to what to do it and who is going to pay for it. That's why I believe, but again, maybe it's my overly academic experience, I believe it's time for us to ask ourselves how we want to tackle those issues and how we want to make the decision and who is going to make the effort. If you look at the I remember a year ago we were lobbying, we the Parliament of NATO, we were lobbying very hard to get the governments to agree to send an additional 2,000 or 3,000 men in Afghanistan to control the presidential election. Today we are going towards the legislative election in Afghanistan with very, very short means. And the demands continue to add, and I'm not sure the defense budgets are continuing. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, there's a lot of hot air about where it should go, but there is no strategic concept. And again, I don't say this to be aggressive to my friend Nick Burns, you know, I don't belong to this category, but I hear I hear conflicting discourse on the American side. Again, you know, people, when I look at the map of American deployment as the Pentagon is now preparing them, and the shrinking part of Europe in this, when I look at the discussion inside the administration as to what they ought to do, whether it's unilateral plus some coalition, or whether it's NATO, as Nick says, I'm sorry to say, Nick, I mean, this is not a very strong voice in this, but Secretary Rumsfeld, in answer to my question last February, said the mission is a coalition. And I do not see, I've yet to see, very clear choices on that. So that's why, you know, I do the job which is mine with great enthusiasm, and I know my fellow MPs do it with great enthusiasm. I would want NATO to be an effective operation. I still do not see in the defense budgets of many of the parties and the way it operates a grand strategic objective, how to deal with it and how to fix it with the other organizations. Maybe this sounds too pessimistic to you, but I believe this is the reality as perceived by many people.
Thank you. Another question from this side, then we switch to the other side. Please.
Thank you, Chairman. I understand I'm permanent to NATO. And I'll touch also an issue of institutional cooperation. Well, I won't be defending EU or NATO to that effect, because there has never been any contradiction between EU and NATO. The contradictions are between member states. As most of the membership is overlapping, quite often it's like arguing with oneself. On personal level, if you were sitting in a corner and arguing with yourself, most likely you would be advised to seek some psychiatric help. In case of institutions, it's a bit different. So I think maybe the background is somewhere else. First, people in Darfur don't give a damn whether the flag is EU, NATO, African Union, whatever, because they are just dying. The same applies to different other crisis areas. So the cooperation seems to be natural, necessary, unavoidable. I think it's just that we are in a phase in history when the nations are dividing the world. In history, they used to do it via wars. Fortunately, this time is different, because it's an issue of leadership. The number one position is occupied, whether we like it or not, globally, it's U.S. But there are a number of local, regional number ones, sub-regional number ones, and sub-sub-regional number ones. So nations position themselves to occupy a leadership position. We feel it basically on a daily basis on different levels. And that's the issue which we're talking about. So basically, both EU and NATO are developing. They have to be developing, because otherwise they would share the fate of dinosaurs if they won't adapt to a changing environment. It's not an issue of EU or NATO. It's issue of nations and issue of political will. Unless there will be political will, nothing will happen. So I think every nation, especially those who are part of both organizations, should first look into the mirror and maybe have this discussion with himself at home, and then we can bring it to institutional level. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Ambassador Burns.
Harry, thanks for your comments. I agree with where you're coming from. I think that that NATO and the EU have to have a clear division of responsibility, because the EU and NATO are completely different institutions, and the EU does many, many things well from the political and economic standpoint. No, it's okay. I was just distracted for a moment. But NATO and the EU have completely different responsibilities in the world. And the EU is the main funder of a lot of the good things that happen in the Balkans. I think 80 to 90% of the international funding is now coming from the EU, and it's had a tremendously positive, transformative effect on a lot of the countries that want to come into the EU, and we should give the EU its due. But the EU cannot shoulder the military responsibility of major peacekeeping operations. The EU doesn't have the money, and European countries are not spending on defense in a way that would allow the EU to play that role. There is no center to the EU defense. There's no command, and there shouldn't be a command. 19 of the 27 members are members of NATO. We have a command. and have had for 56 years. And so I think the problem occurs when there are people on the EU side who have this vision that somehow the EU should take over from NATO. And there you're going to find very stiff resistance from countries that are not in the EU, like the United States. Why would you want to create an alternative NATO in EU? Why would you want to spend billions of euro to construct the same institutions that we've just built over 56 years? So let the EU do what it does well in Darfur, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. But let's not kid ourselves if you're talking about security deployments of tens of thousands of troops or even less. It's going to be NATO that will remain the only institution that has the capacity to undertake those institutions. And Pierre, I could not disagree with you more about what you said about NATO and about U.S. views. I think you just perhaps don't realize that what we've just done over the last 5 or 6 years is define a new strategic vision for this organization, which is now being implemented. And we're in the places that we want to be, not because we're in search of a role, because, as Bogdan says, because we've never been busier, because people are asking us to deploy troops to their region. And the United States has made its choice. We're involved in all these NATO missions. But we're involved in other parts of the world, in Southeast Asia, for instance, in Latin America, where NATO clearly does not have a role. So don't be surprised by that. Don't be surprised that the United States will be off doing other things. But if you're looking for a commitment to Europe, 107,000 American troops are in Europe. 60 years after the end of the Second World War, we still provide the nuclear and conventional defense of Europe, NATO, through the United States, 60 years after the end of the war. I'm not sure what more we can do to satisfy your question, except to say, I hope that this vision that somehow the EU and NATO should separate, which is very much a vision that comes out of your country, I hope it does not succeed. I hope the vision that comes out of other countries, that is, we should have continued alliance between America and Europe, that succeeds.
Thank you.
I'm Yanis Zeppos. I'm the Greek ambassador to NATO. First of all, many thanks to the panelists for extremely interesting presentations. I would like to come to Kosovo for a minute. Some of the panelists mentioned, when they discussed the future of Kosovo, mentioned that it's an issue that eventually could find its solution during 2005, and that in trying to find the solution, Serbia and Montenegro should be involved in the process. Now, Nick Burns mentioned that, of course, the conditionality issue is always there and always strong. Therefore, I would like to ask if within the next coming months, let's say, when we are searching for the final status after the issue of the standards, and considering that we have not gone much further on the conditionality issue, what else could we do to involve Belgrade in this issue in order to have them assist in finding a solution for Kosovo? Thank you.
Thank you. Somebody would like to respond?
Ambassador, I'm very glad for the question. I'd respond by saying that the conditionality actually has been producing results in the last few months, and I've got a few extra copies of the briefing we published on Monday, which I'm happy to share with you and anybody else who's interested afterwards. I would say that what we need to be saying to our Serbian friends, and what I am saying to my Serbian friends, is this. Look, if you want to be serious about Kosovo, first of all, the international community has decided to resolve it quickly. So it's up to you whether you make the internal adjustments that are necessary for you to get involved. And secondly, think about the long term. Do you really want Kosovo as part of your country dragging you down economically? Because nobody else is going to help you if you take on responsibility for it. I think there is reality dawning in Belgrade as to what the future arrangements are likely to be. And I would say that it's incumbent on all of us to be absolutely clear with our Serb interlocutors as to what that reality is going to be. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving the floor to a voice from civil society. My name is Ivan Vejvoda. I run the Balkan Trust for Democracy, which is a project of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. And serendipitously, I'm based in Belgrade and from Belgrade, so there's a minor presence of Serbian Montenegro through a citizen. through a transatlantic organization, may I add. I think it's by no mere chance that the Balkans are put up there in front of the elusive elsewhere, because I think the concert of the U.S., NATO, and the EU working in the Balkans is to be heralded as a success of partnership. And I think, as many of the panelists have said, we are close to success. And my worry is not 2008, but actually these next 2-3 years to 2008, when I think we will all be candidates, some countries will be members. And as Minister Grabar Kitarovic said, we are championing each other's movements at their own pace into the Euro-Atlantic organizations. And thus, everything is in the nuance, and I also applaud the nuances of Undersecretary Burns in his recent statements. I think it's also about flexibility. The conditionalities are clear, and again, I'm convinced that all our countries who have the outstanding obligations to The Hague will meet them soon. But as we know from, for example, the sanctions that were put on one of our countries in the region, it took a bit of time to understand that there was something called smart sanctions. We're talking about smart visas today. How do we get the youth of the region to know Europe when we know that, for example, 70% of Serbian students have never traveled, let alone to Bosnia, Macedonia, not even to France? So the trust that I run has been heralded, in fact, by USAID, for example, as a very good way to enhance democracy, reform, institution building. We have garnered European support. May I commend the Greek, Dutch, and Swedish governments who have joined this trust after USAID, German Marshall Fund, and the Mott Foundation, because they see the wealth of the regional activity that we engage in supporting cross-border and multi-country issues, from reconciliation projects to municipal linking citizens to governments project. And I think, and this is one lesson I think that we should draw from the concert of the transatlantic relation here, is that there is a lot to learn further eastwards and southwards from this experience in the Balkans. And I think we should all put our minds both in the sort of hard-nosed policy that we're engaged in, but also in what Kemal Dervish was talking about, the link between security, civic, and economics. I would add the third term to it, and see what we can do further afield in the Black Sea and the greater Middle East. May I seize this occasion to humbly suggest to our colleagues of the Adriatic Charter that being a an indigenous regional venture, that they do invite Bosnia-Herzegovina and Serbia and Montenegro to join. Another very successful example of how the region sees that its fate is linked, although we travel at our own speeds, and how we can tend out a hand to each other to move faster. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anybody would like to answer this? Or shall we have another question over there? Because, yeah.
Eric Pierre, I was the first Swedish ambassador to Sarajevo and to Skopje during the war. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. First, many thanks for the organizers of this meeting and for the interventions from the panelists. The question I would like to go on to is, when I served in Bosnia in the 90s, we had a lot of hope for the future. But we see today that there is still weak institutions in the country, not only in Bosnia, in the Western Balkans. It's a weak economic development. There's a lack of cohesion in the country. And I think one should go back and look what went wrong in pre-Dayton or in Dayton, which has caused this. One of the questions I would like to underline is the introduction of Republika Srpska at the time has made it much more difficult to create a cohesion within Bosnia-Herzegovina, and including the problem of the ethnic cleansing in 92 is now basically permanent. It has not changed both for Muslims who were thrown out and also from Serbs from the western part of Bosnia. And I would like to also add the question of finding Mladic and Karadzic. During the time in 96, NATO forces were about 60,000 men, and they failed for all the time there to find Mladic and Karadzic. So I think NATO has to share some part of the reasons why these two war criminals have not been brought to justice.
Thank you. I'll take another question from this side, and then we shall have the final round here. Distinguished representative of Spain.
There's somebody else. I cannot avoid to intervene. Nick is not now here, but I mean, when Andras Varsany also intervenes, they are all friends of mine, both of them. So I'm going to to compliment a little bit the dialogue. Well, I think the Balkans really has been a good example of international cooperation, and the truth is that several ministers from the region this morning, members of the panel and not, have referred of the importance of the fact that without Belgrade there is anything to do. I have to say to Nicholas White, I mean, we know well the views of the international crisis group, so I'm not surprised of your views, but it doesn't mean that necessarily I agree with them. But the question goes a little bit online, as Yanis, suppose the Greek ambassador, did. I wish you, Nick, a lot of luck with your ideas. Obviously, we followed with a lot of interest your interventions in the House, in the Congress in the United States. There were also other interveners there, so you knew very well the views of the region, the people who accompanied you in Washington recently. But the question is, precisely a person you referred this morning, our common colleague and friend, Kai Aide, he has presented ideas of how to anchor more Belgrade during this process. The point is that, I mean, we are a little bit worried in the sense that, I mean, nobody is discussing conditionality. Nobody is discussing defense reform. But meanwhile, we have to do something. I'm not going to go now of how we interpret Reykjavik, because this is an EPC security forum. It's not a formal ministerial. But this is another question. The question is that, I mean, meanwhile, we have to help the moderates, as people said here. We expect as well that in your visit to the region, I mean, very soon, these ideas could be passed. Kai Aide has ideas to this effect, which count with a tremendous support in the NATO Council. The Taylor program, for instance, I mean, defense liaison officer in Belgrade. There are ways of giving visibility to the moderates there. Also, the Poles are in their favor at the moment. I mean, the work that President Tadic is doing in Serbia is of tremendous importance, and we have to sustain them. On Kosovo, we'll see now what happens with the standards, but obviously, as everybody knows, future of Kosovo lies within the European Union. And the point is, in order to sustain this status, obviously with standards, because standards will continue, the problem is how many times we have been speaking about fighting against corruption and organized crime there. I mean, is this sustainable? So in that sense, we believe that as future of Kosovo lies also within the European Union, we have to be very strict as well concerning the future development there. But we should not isolate Belgrade. Thank you. Thank you very much. And reinforce Kosovo. Obviously, I said very much. And we are a little bit worried of the fact that isolating Solfo, Kosovo, and reinforcing the views of President Rugova like that, I know that this should not be like that, this is dangerous. So we have to complement one effort with the other. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We are pressed for time, so I would like to give the last word to the participants of the panel on this side, and then we shall conclude our session. Please, Mr. Ellis.
Well, I just finished with one comment. I think that if we feel that we want institutions to be able to work together, and particularly in the Balkans, then it's essential that in all parts those who wish to cooperate together to make this successful have the opportunity to do so. I'm the longest-serving member of the Budget Committee in the European Parliament. We authorize the funds for the Balkans, but we have no way to talk with our congressional counterparts as to how these funds can be properly coordinated. I gave the example in Afghanistan. It also happens in Iraq. Therefore, simply appeal to the EU-US summit on the 20th of June that you take the steps necessary to involve the political communities, the relevant political communities in this instance. Otherwise, you'll find ourselves going in different directions, and that would be undesirable.
Colinda.
Thank you. Yes, just a few brief comments, listening to the comments from the audience, which are more than welcome, because it all helps us all in dealing with these issues and in setting policies. First, I would like to point out that the Thessaloniki conclusions confirm the European perspective of all the countries of the stabilization and association process, meaning Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Macedonia, Albania, and Serbia and Montenegro. As someone pointed out, we're all going at our own speeds, and I think this is the best possible approach, the individual approach, so the effort that you put into the structural reform at home, which are aimed at fulfilling the criteria, but first and foremost aimed at creating a better life in your own country for the benefit of your own citizens and for the stability of the region. I think that these provide a great incentive for the region to move on. We can learn a lot from each other, and Croatia is more than willing to share its experience to assist all the neighbors and to give all the possible support, the political, the technical, the logistical, every kind of support to the reformist forces in all our neighboring countries. Thank you.
Monsieur le Président.
Merci, Monsieur le Ministre. Just three quick thoughts. We need to improve the coordination between the various institutions involved in international security. It's clear. We need to find a new legal legitimacy to do that and to intervene early and not let the principle of sovereignty and domestic affairs permit the assassination of people by local governments. We need to bring to justice those who do this and therefore link up these efforts with the International Criminal Court. First thought. Second, in terms of EU and NATO, Nick, I am a European Atlanticist. I believe that NATO is a terrific military instrument, that it no longer does what it used to be to do during the Cold War. But also as a European, I do not believe we should get into a division of labor in which you do the serious stuff and we do the little stuff, the civilian stuff. You do the cooking, we do the dishwashing. This is not a reasonable way to address the world's strategic problem ahead of us. So while I'm all in favor, and you know it, I'm one of rare voices in France who really values the U.S. and NATO alliance, I really believe that, you know, this has to be balanced out a little better. Otherwise, we will continue to have major political division among us, and that's not good.
Thank you, Mr. President. Nick?
We are optimistic that there can be progress in the Balkans in 2005 on Kosovo. Can you not hear me? We are optimistic that 2005 can be a year of progress on Kosovo, and hopefully a year of reconciliation with Serbia-Montenegro and a year of unification in Bosnia. And we're going to dedicate a lot of our efforts to that. My final comment, of course, we want to see NATO and the EU cooperate well and the EU play the role it should. But what Berlin Plus was all about, and if you want to change it, we'll have to have a major renegotiation. But I don't think most people want to change it, is that the EU will seek to borrow resources from NATO when it has to. But the EU will not seek to duplicate what NATO already has. The vast majority of Europeans agree with that, but apparently you do not. And other people, perhaps in your government, do not. And that's where the argument is. But it's not much of an argument that matters, because we're going ahead. The EU does not have the capacity to do what NATO does in a military sense, and should not, unless you want to appropriate billions of euro, which I don't believe your parliament and others will do. And so let's just get it straight that NATO does do the major military operations. The EU will do the Petersburg tasks, and the two of us will be very happy. But if you're seeking a competitive relationship, then I think you're going to find a competitive relationship where you're not going to be very happy. And the world is not going to operate as efficiently as it should. we Europeans and Americans should agree on that division of labor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Mr. White?
Yeah, three sentences. First, I was very glad that Monsieur Lelouch is keen to oppose national caveats, and I hope you'll be saying that to your own parliament, because I understand this is still a problem in some respects with French deployment in KFOR. Second, a couple of people have brought up the economic issue, including the Macedonian foreign minister and the mention of the dervish equation. It seems to me one thing the EU could be looking at here is relaxing the visa regime, which is, at the moment simply penalises honest travellers and rewards people traffickers. It seems to me that what Ivan Vevoda has been talking about in terms of smart visas is part of the way to go, but I'd much rather see people going much further along those lines. Finally, we'll know that we no longer have to have these sessions once Karadzic and Mladic have been arrested. Once that happens, then I think there's no question about Bosnia-Herzegovina joining PFP. There's no question about Serbia and Montenegro joining PFP. And frankly, there should be no question about continued presence of the High Representative in Bosnia. That's the moment when we can declare the mission has been successful. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I shall conclude very briefly. I must say that I liked very much the comment that came from our Estonian colleague, I think, regarding the people of Darfur not caring about acting in concert, but rather expecting some action. Indeed, I could see that most of us share some very important values, and this should be continued and cherished and protected as much as possible. Sticking together regarding the hotspots in the modern world is extremely important. I didn't see any disagreement in this group here today regarding activities in places like Uzbekistan or Kosovo or Kyrgyzstan, and this is really a very, very important message. I think that common work or work in concert between organizations like NATO, OSCE, UN, EU is irreplaceable and unavoidable, but more detailed report will be composed by our colleague Jamie Shee, and so I can conclude. I thank everybody for very interesting contributions, and first of all, my colleagues here on this side of the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dimitri. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you.